You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Ideas Network is bringing you a documentary series about a little-known process with massive consequences. It's called WPR Reports Mapped Out, and it's a deep dive into redistricting and what it has meant for our state. In the second episode, WPR's Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson tell the story of how Wisconsin's 2011 district maps were drawn.
It can be dangerous to predict how future historians might write the political history of Wisconsin, but it seems like they might have a lot to say about the year 2011.
Because in terms of state politics, 2011 was the year that changed everything.
Wisconsin had this reputation as a progressive beacon that went way back, more than a century, from labor protections to breaking up monopolies to the nation's first state income tax. This was part of our legacy.
And then 2011 happened.
If you lived in Wisconsin in 2011, and even if you didn't, you might remember it was kind of chaotic.
Scott Walker, a conservative Republican from Milwaukee County, has just been elected governor. And about a month after he takes office, he introduces a plan that would decimate the state's public employee unions.
Suddenly, people who normally don't care much about state government do. Tens of thousands of people show up in downtown Madison for weeks. Every day you hear crowds chanting.
People literally take over the Capitol. Some of them actually live there for a while. They're shouting and drumming off and on all day, and then at night, they line the building's marble floors with their sleeping bags. Then they start all over again in the morning.
One day in March, 100,000 people show up at the Capitol for a rally. They spill out onto the sidewalk and the street and into downtown. It's so crowded that it's hard to move.
The same week as that giant historic rally, the same week Walker signs the law that changes unions forever, another event goes largely unnoticed. The U.S. Census Bureau releases its redistricting data.
Republican staffers and consultants begin work at a private law firm right across the street from the Capitol. They call their office the Map Room. And at this moment in history, during this chaos, work on redistricting, one of the most consequential bills of the decade, quietly begins.
From WPR Reports, I'm Bridget Bowden.
And I'm Sean Johnson. This is Mapped Out. Now, we just said redistricting began quietly, but it's not like it snuck up on people. It happens every 10 years on a schedule. Remember episode one? The census happens every decade and then redistricting. This was not a surprise.
In fact, just a year before, in the 2010 campaign for governor, one of the candidates actually made it part of his platform.
Well, good morning. I'm very, very pleased this morning to have just submitted my papers to become a candidate for governor here in the state of Wisconsin.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, the Democrat running that year, held a press conference outside the state's elections agency on the day he turned in his nomination papers. He was talking about redistricting. He wanted to change the way the state drew its maps.
Barrett's plan would have given the state's elections board more power over the process. He also wanted a new requirement in state law. Redistricting plans must be competitive.
That it certainly is worth exploring a very serious alternative to do this in a way that makes it less partisan, less litigation-driven, in the hopes that we can get a truly representative democracy here in the state of Wisconsin. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This might be a good time to remind you about what government looks like in 2010. It's easy to forget, but at the time, Democrats are running everything.
And we mean everything. The White House, the U.S. House and Senate, the Wisconsin Governor's Office, and the full Wisconsin Legislature. But those Democrats haven't really made redistricting a priority. Tom Barrett is one of the only people talking about this. And later, even Barrett basically abandons the issue. Because this is 2010.
This is 2 years after President Obama was elected, just a few months after he signed the Affordable Care Act. The Great Recession is still fresh on people's minds, and so is Obama's federal stimulus package.
there's a backlash against Democrats, and the Republican base is fired up. GOP strategists are looking for ways to seize power.
One of them is Republican Chris Jankowski. In 2010, he's running a national group that's focused on state races. He knows the power that state legislatures hold, and he pitches that to donors.
They would just give me 10% of what they were spending federally. I swear I could, you know, have an impact.
Now, Jankowski's group always focuses on state races. It's kind of their niche. But he knows they matter most of all this year, a year ending in zero, because whoever wins will be in charge of redistricting.
He creates a program called Red Map, the Redistricting Majority Project. The goal? Flip state legislatures to give Republicans the power to draw maps.
Jankowski's group funnels this national money to local districts where the numbers suggest Republicans could win.
We used data and objective research. We didn't have to actually meet the candidates to know what we could do.
Now, his group is hardly the only one spending money in 2010. Republicans and Democrats and their political allies around the nation throw billions of dollars around.
But Jankowski's group is methodical, targeted.
They get involved in races where people don't necessarily expect it. And they do this in districts all over the country, including districts in Wisconsin.
Leading up to Election Day, pretty much everyone expects Republicans to do well. This is historically how it goes in midterms. When one party controls everything, the pendulum tends to swing back the other way.
But on election night, when results start rolling in, they're dramatic.
The Republicans ride a wave of voter anger to take back control of the House. What's flashing red are the seats that used to belong to the Democrats.
Look at the swath of red, a sweep, just a bloodbath for the Democrats in Pennsylvania. You cannot underestimate how much change in America is now colored red. It was blue in 2006. It was blue in 2008. It is red now. It is Republican. And Democrats looking ahead to 2012, beginning with the president.
Plenty of states get swept up in this wave, but nowhere does it hit harder than in Wisconsin. In the governor's race, Walker handily beats Barrett.
In the race for U.S. Senate, Republican Ron Johnson beats progressive icon Russ Feingold. Republicans flip Wisconsin's congressional delegation. And in the state legislature, Republicans capture majorities in the Senate and Assembly.
It's apparent almost immediately that Republicans have won more than just one election on November 2nd of 2010. They've won the biggest prize of all, the power to draw the maps that will shape elections for the next decade.
How the maps came together after the break.
It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to WPR Reports Mapped Out with Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson.
One of the people watching the election results come in that night in 2010 is Republican strategist Joe Handrick.
Handrick has decades of experience in politics. He ran his first campaign for the state legislature when he was still in college in the 80s. He eventually won seats in the state assembly and Senate, not to mention a stint as chairman of the Northwoods town of Minocqua. And his interest in politics goes way back.
Yeah, it probably happened sophomore year in high school when I became to the realization that I was never going to be a starter on the football team, and I was never going to be a starter on the cross-country team. But boy, I was good at figuring out how to get elected to student council.
Eventually, Handrick leaves office to become a Republican political strategist. And when we say strategist, that's probably selling it short. When it comes to elections, Handrick's brain is like a computer. He sees patterns that other people might miss.
And when Republicans win, he knows it's a big deal for his party because he specializes in redistricting. He worked on maps for Republicans in the 1990s and the 2000s. He's so highly regarded by Republicans that they hire him again in 2011.
So I was basically a contract hire.
And when he says contract hire, there are a few layers to that. Handrick was hired by a law firm that was hired by another law firm that was hired by Republican legislative leaders to help with the map drawing.
Handrick and the other map drawers don't work from the state capitol. They set up shop across the street at the private law firm Michael Best and Friedrich. They call their office the map room.
Handrick isn't working alone. There are also some lawyers and legislative aides who work for the two most powerful people in the legislature, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald. And yeah, they're brothers.
They also set the agenda for everything that goes through the legislature, including redistricting.
But they use a tactic here that's not typical for most legislation. They force every rank-and-file Republican lawmaker to sign confidentiality agreements. Some people call them secrecy oaths.
One by one, every GOP senator and representative visits this law firm for their chance to see their district, and their district only. And under the terms of the confidentiality agreements, they have to keep it private. Handrick says he wouldn't have done all that, but it wasn't really his call. He says he had a specific assignment.
So my focus was on having a map created that could pass court muster.
Pass court muster. Yes, even when there's single party control, courts can still be involved in redistricting, but their role is different.
Mostly, courts are looking at whether the map meets the requirements of the Voting Rights Act. That is, a map has to make sure that the voice of minority communities gets heard, that they can vote for the candidates they want.
This is one of Handrick's specialties, making sure a map meets this rule by drawing what are known as majority-minority districts.
My source of selfish pride has always been that this kid from up north has been able to have a real and tangible role in helping improve minority representation in Wisconsin.
Also, remember those traditional redistricting criteria we talked about in the last episode? Districts have to be equal in population, compact, contiguous, and respect local boundary lines. Handrick wants a map that satisfies all those, too.
I've had a real good knack for being able to take the complex competing criteria and make them work together.
To hear Handrick describe this, it's an art. Every mapmaker can prioritize these criteria in different ways.
Handrick puts an emphasis on compactness. He doesn't want to see funny-shaped districts. He says those are how you know a map is gerrymandered.
But here's the thing. Other mapmakers disagree, including one who worked with Handrick on the 2011 map.
His name is Keith Gaddy. He's a professor at the University of Oklahoma, and he's written a bunch of books about politics. He even wrote a chapter about Handrick in one of them.
In 2011, Keith Gaddy is such an expert in redistricting that he gets hired in states all over the country to help draw maps. This is his second time working on redistricting in Wisconsin.
At a forum in 2020, Gaddy said there's nothing inherently good about prioritizing one of these criteria over another. So, for example, Handrick doesn't like funny-shaped districts. But Gaddy said that doesn't matter.
Yeah, and optics matter, but optics can fool you, which is we could draw you a perfectly square district that was a gerrymander. I'm not sure where it would be, but we know we could do this thing. So don't let shape fool you.
And remember what Handrick said about creating minority districts?
Gaddy said that can actually help Republicans. Think of it this way. Black voters, especially in Milwaukee, overwhelmingly vote Democrat. So when they're packed in to a small number of districts, it gives Democrats less power in the legislature.
So in crafting majority-minority districts, you're necessarily going to introduce some skew in the map that will naturally tend towards a Republican advantage.
If it seems like Gaddy has a different view of mapmaking than Handrick, well, it's because he does. Mapmaking is super complicated. There's a lot to argue over. And even mapmakers who worked on the same project together can have different priorities.
So with something so complex, how does a mapmaker explain this stuff? Not only to the general public, but to legislators.
Because remember what we learned last episode in Mr. Olson's government class? In Wisconsin, the state constitution says the legislature is responsible for drawing the maps. They get a chance to vote on the plan like any other bill.
On July 11th, 2011, the redistricting bill that mapmakers have been working on behind closed doors for months is introduced.
And by the way, this is the very first time that Democratic lawmakers get to look at this at all. Even though that private law firm has been working for the legislature, Democrats were not allowed to see their own districts or anyone else's.
2 days later, the redistricting bill gets its first and only public hearing.
Joe Hendrick doesn't testify at this hearing. Neither does Keith Gaddy.
And the Fitzgerald brothers, the two most powerful people in the legislature, they don't testify either.
My name is Tad Ottman.
They send Tad Ottman and Adam Foltz, their legislative aides who are working across the street in the map room.
Ottman does most of the talking, and he starts right away by saying their map meets the traditional principles of redistricting.
Equal population, sensitivity to minority concerns, and compact and contiguous districts.
When Foltz testifies, it's all about numbers. He rattles them off without stopping.
Same applies to Assembly District 29, also overpopulated by somewhere around 9,000 people. It shrunk to shed its overpopulation, and 28 was the least growing of the three, only 2,000 overpopulated.
Shrunk it's a lot of information to take in.
Some of what Ottman and Foltz say that day contradicts itself.
For example, they say they decided to put the cities of Kenosha and Racine together in one Senate district.
So it unites two urban, large urban areas that...
That decision, Ottman says, let them keep rural areas separate.
But in Sheboygan, they kind of did the opposite. They could have put the entire city in a single assembly district surrounded by a rural area. Instead, they chopped it in two.
Either choice is legally valid. It's a matter of making a choice on the map.
You get a sense at this hearing that the lawmakers listening, even the Republican chairing the committee, are a little overwhelmed.
All right, well, thank you for your thorough comments this morning. I kind of feel like I'm back in Statistics 101 here, and appreciate your work on this.
When lawmakers start to ask questions, they typically want to know about their districts. They know these places. Why did you move a line here or there? What was your reasoning?
Ottman fields most of the questions, and his answers are the same. The map meets the traditional redistricting criteria. Therefore, it's legal. He comes back to this over and over.
As I kind of started out my presentation, there's three core principles that go into any reapportionment plan, and that's equal population, compact mm-hmm. and contiguous, and sensitivity.
But as I mentioned,
there are different legal principles, and making a choice on those principles may lead you to compromise the other principle or to weigh the other.
I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, but it kind of comes back to the same point.
It's there are reapportionment principles that are applied to any map drawing, and you have to make choices between them.
For most of the hearing, the room is quiet. And this is pretty unusual for this period in Wisconsin history. Remember, this hearing is happening in between the passage of Scott Walker's big union law and the recall elections to come. People are mad. Hearings are often interrupted by shouting.
But there is one politely confrontational moment. Senator John Erpenbach, a Democrat from Dane County, wants to know whether they looked at any other criteria when they drew this map, like whether the map is good for Republicans.
And I'm sorry, what was your first question?
First question is, did you look at the partisan makeup of the districts?
That information was made available to all four caucuses by the
GOP. But you guys had the legal representation, we didn't.
Erpenbach asks some form of this question again and again. And every time, Ottman dodges. After a long back and forth, Erpenbach gives it one more shot.
Did the partisan makeup of the districts come into play at all when drawing the maps?
And again, Ottman comes back to the traditional redistricting criteria.
The principles were the ones I enumerated. Those were the ones that drove drawing the map.
So the answer is no?
The answer is that we follow those three legal principles by which the map...
2 days later, this committee run by Republicans passes the map. It passes the state assembly and Senate just days after that.
There are 19 ayes, 14 noes. Senate Bill 148 is passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
This is not like the other big stuff happening in 2011. There's no chanting, no outrage, and in just a few weeks, Walker signs it.
But it wouldn't be until the next election, in November of 2012, that Wisconsin would see the power of this map.
That's next week on Mapped Out.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden.
And Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by John K. Wilson, and digital direction by David Hyland.
Photography by Angela Major, artwork by John Nichols. Audio of Chris Jankowski, provided by NPR's Planet Money.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
And next week on WPR Reports Mapped Out, we go back a decade and explore what the 2011 map looked like and what's in use today. Ahead this hour, it's the rise of plastic surgery in the pandemic. Have you had plastic or reconstructive surgery recently? Do you know someone who has? What were the circumstances and decisions around the procedure? What questions do you have for the surgeon? A line for you, 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For the past year and a half, COVID has upended study abroad for college students. And this year, many students in Wisconsin are hoping to get their second and last chance to spend a semester in another country before graduation. But Rich Kramer reports there's still lingering uncertainty due to the pandemic. We're going to switch gears here now to the uptick in plastic and reconstructive surgery in these times. According to a survey earlier this year from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, the first wave of pandemic-related pent-up demand saw a rush on facial procedures in response to a significant surge in Zoom calls and downtime for discreet recovery at home. Have you or a loved one had cosmetic or reconstructive surgery? What were the circumstances and decisions around the procedure? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Ahmed Afifi is an associate professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's president-elect of the Wisconsin Society of Plastic Surgeons. Dr. Afifi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on your show.
Good morning. Start with some broad stroke observations, if you would. What are you seeing in capacity and in trends and procedures in these pandemic times?
Absolutely. So this was sort of unexpected. We didn't think that the pandemic would lead to this hugely increased demand on plastic surgery. So when the pandemic started, we obviously all shut down our offices for safety reasons and to save masks and to help with our ICU colleagues. But then once we opened up, the demand was much more than usual. At first, we thought it is just the backlog of patients who were canceled during the early phase of the pandemic, but this has persisted now for the last 14 months. Mm-hmm. And I think there are several possible reasons for that. Like you mentioned, one of them is being able to work from home. So patients can now have major surgery, and then going back to work basically means going to the dinner table and opening their laptop and logging back to work. So they can be back to work in probably 2 or 3 days in a rather more comfortable setting. The other thing is the Zoom, that everyone is working on Zoom right now and everything is online. So that small picture that we all see of ourselves in the top right corner, mm-hmm. people are looking at that picture and saying, wow, I'm seeing more lines. And men are saying, I have more hair loss than what I thought. And this is something that patients have always told us from even before the Zoom thing, is that they would say, I look at the mirror and I see a different person than what I feel. I feel much younger. I feel much more energized than the person I see in the mirror. And I just want to look as good as I feel.
You know, we've talked with some professions, like yesterday, a veterinarian oncologist who said staffing is really difficult in our profession. The turnover in vets and vet techs is a huge problem. Is your specialty facing a staffing crunch?
I think it is the same across all specialties. I think plastic surgeons in general, the surgeons themselves, we have a very happy profession. We all love what we do and no one is leaving plastic surgery. Yes, finding staff and nurses can be hard. There's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of demand across all aspects of healthcare, I think, right now.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find that insurance covers your patient's surgery, or are your patients mainly paying completely out of pocket?
That's a great question. I'm so glad you asked that question. So a large part of what we do are out of pocket, like cosmetic patients, they're paying out of pocket, and and insurance doesn't cover it. However, there are many things that we call functional plastic surgery. There are many procedures that many patients can have insurance cover them, and patients just do not know that insurance covered them. Hmm. The easiest example, because this just happened to me this week, are people who have droopiness of their eyebrows or their eyelids over time, and is starting to obstruct their visual field. They cannot see anymore. They have to, with their hands, lift their eyebrows so that they can have full field of vision. And this is something that insurance covers and has always covered, and many patients are not aware of that. There are so many other examples I can give you. People who have headaches, people who cannot breathe through their nose, people who have large breasts causing back pain, many other examples of things that can be covered by insurance, and many patients are not aware of that.
And what about like cancer patients who have a mastectomy? Would that be something that might be covered?
Absolutely. That's actually a large part of my practice. And this was a federal law that was passed in the 90s that mandates that with any breast cancer surgery, the insurance has to cover reconstruction.
Hmm, yeah. What about things like scar removal or skin lacerations? Would that be considered reconstructive in nature that insurers might be willing to cover?
Yes, absolutely. So the line between reconstructive and cosmetic is not a very sharp line.
Mm-hmm.
So I do lots of reconstructive surgery. I tell patients I do everything with a cosmetic background, with a cosmetic mindset. So yes, improving the appearance of scars, whether by surgery or by lasers, is something that many insurances would cover.
We're talking with Dr. Ahmed Afifi, plastic and reconstructive surgeon, former president of the Midwestern Association of Plastic Surgeons. We're discussing the surge of patients in his specialty in these times and the nature of the work. Have you had plastic surgery recently? Do you know someone who has? What were some of the decisions you made, and how did it affect your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Afifi, what role has telemedicine had in cosmetic surgery and in your specialty?
Yes, another thing that has totally changed in the last year is telemedicine. So now we can see patients online, either for their first visit or for even visits after surgery. I'm sure it has been the same for you, Kate, at your show and having guests. It's mm-hmm. it's a totally different dynamics.
Yeah, it really is.
And now many patients, we see them online for the first visit, especially if patients live a few hours away. They don't have to travel. They can see us online. And one of the good things about seeing them online is I'm not wearing a mask. They're not wearing a mask. So we can actually have more of a normal human-to-human interaction without wearing masks, and post-operative visits after the surgery. So now patients, again, continuing recovering from home, we can just log in, we can take a look at the wound, make sure they're doing well. And this has totally changed the field, because now patients can have an online visit with a surgeon next door in Wisconsin, or someone in Australia, or someone in Texas. So it's opened many options for patients.
So for instance, too, if a patient travels to Florida or another state or is living part of the year somewhere else, that they can still do those follow-up visits.
Correct. And I've had many patients who were my patients here in Wisconsin, then they moved somewhere else, and then they're coming back for their surgery with me. So we can see them online and prepare them for the surgery and answer any questions that they have.
I'm wondering, you know, a cosmetic plastic surgery, it starts with a consultation, and, you know, the patient says, "Doctor, am I a good candidate for this procedure?" And you discuss risks, of course. Do you find that there have been new advancements and new technologies that enable you to do surgeries that weren't possible even a decade ago?
Absolutely. And I used to hear this from my mentors when I was in training many years ago, that they would say that the procedures they're performing then are very different than what they learned during their training and medical school and residency. And it's the same here. Plastic surgery is advancing at a very, very fast rate. Many of the procedures I'm doing now are very different from what I was doing 10 years ago. In every single aspect that we do, in cosmetic surgery, in breast reconstruction, the technology in lasers, the different fillers that we have, and even our techniques for recovery and what medications we're giving for patients, for pain control, for recovery, everything is advancing very fast.
Yeah, you bring up so many points that I want to dig into. What has the effect been with lasers? What can you do with laser surgery?
Many things. So lasers alone, they're very helpful for many patients with a multitude of skin conditions, whether it's some pigment, whether it's fine lines. And our numbers show that, again, laser skin resurfacing by plastic surgeons, around 1 million are done every single year in the U.S. And that's just one type of laser resurfacing. Another common one is what's called IPL for brown spots. Again, that's around 830,000 that are done every year by plastic surgeons. So it depends on what the patient's looking for, and we have many different options.
You talk about fillers, and it just reminds me of the silicone gel breast implant global settlement that brought Dow to its knees in the 90s. I remember that very well. What have you seen by way of the change in what is injected and what fill is used in people?
Correct. So most of the fillers that we use today, and for your listeners, that's a very common procedure. Again, our statistics show that by plastic surgeons, 3.5 million were done in 2019. The fillers that we have today are much safer. Most of them are reversible. Most of them can be removed if we have any issues or the patients are not happy. However, even although it's 3-4 million done every single year, it's still something that you have to take your due diligence before doing them. So you have to choose your surgeon or your provider carefully and make sure that you understand what the risks are, what your options are, and what your expectations are, because that's the only way to get a happy and safe result.
We're discussing the rise in plastic and reconstructive surgery in these times with UW Health Surgeon Ahmed Afifi. Have you wondered if you're a good candidate for a procedure? Have you had nasal surgery, functional nasal surgery, to address migraine headache pain? We'll talk more about that. What was the outcome of your plastic surgery? How long did it take to recover? Join in 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. We'll pick this up with Dr. Afifi in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for a conversation about plastic and reconstructive surgery on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, the highest number of cosmetic surgeries in 2020 were nose reshaping, eyelid surgery, and facelifts. In reconstructive surgery, in that area, the top were tumor removal, laceration repair, and scar revision. Did you have any of these procedures? What do you want to ask the surgeon? It's 800-642-1234. We have plastic and reconstructive surgeon Ahmed Afifi, who's with us for about 5 more minutes. Dr. Afifi, you know, I'm wondering, there is a psychological component to your profession in that you have to help your patients set reasonable expectations for the outcome, for how this procedure will make them look, how it will make them feel. How do you do that? How do you set those expectations?
That's a great question. And it's something that we all plastic surgeons are trying to be better at knowing what the patient's expectations and goals are and setting the right realistic mutual goals for both of us. I think if patients are unhappy, usually that's where the breakdown was, that the surgeon and the patient did not have the same expectation, the same goals. So this, there is no math to it. This is just an experience. we sit with patients, we discuss with them, what are you expecting out of this procedure? What are your goals? So we know that expression follows emotion. The people who are sad tend to frown more, and people who frown more tend to be sad. And the other thing is this, the opposite is also true. People who tend to smile more are happier, and if they're happier, they smile more. And that is also contagious. So when someone who's smiling walks into a room, people around him start to smile more and start to feel happier. So know that plastic surgery, it changes many aspects of the patient's life. Multiple studies in all types of plastic surgery from all continents show that plastic surgery improves the patient's quality of life. It improves their self-confidence. It improves the first impression that they get. So it has very positive impacts on their quality of life, as long as we both have realistic expectations.
Dr. Afifi, how do you think social media and what people see on social media affects cosmetic surgery?
So this has impacted us in positive ways and maybe not so positive ways. In positive ways, because number one, people are seeing themselves on social media. So there's no doubt about it. People are having their pictures on Instagram and on Facebook all the time. And they want to look good in these pictures. They want to look happy in these pictures. They want to look as good as they feel in these pictures. So yes, it does encourage more people to have plastic surgery. The other thing is patient education. So today, many more patients are open about having plastic surgery. It isn't as secretive as it used to be before. Many of my patients now, they come to me because they know that their friends and their family have had plastic surgery with me, and they're so open about it. At the same time, it does sometimes put unnecessary pressure on patients to have plastic surgery, and that's where what you just mentioned a second ago is just having the consultation with the patient and the discussion with them to make sure that we have realistic expectations of what the plastic surgery can do for you.
Yeah, that you're on the same page. I want to talk about one procedure before we have to go, and it's migraine headaches. What can you tell us about functional nasal surgery and whether this can help relieve chronic headaches?
So surgery for headaches is probably one of the most exciting advances in plastic surgery in the last 20 years. Briefly, this was discovered by total chance. That people were having plastic surgery and they found that their headaches improved. Like, we plastic surgeons, we never thought we'd be treating headaches. And then we started researching it, and we found that during the plastic surgery, we were somehow taking pressure off certain nerves or certain structures around the head, and these could be triggering headaches. Now, this was 25 years ago. Right now, we have a society, the Migraine Surgery Society. We have a ton of research showing the different nerves and the different structures that we can work on around the head that could be contributing or triggering or making their migraines or their headaches worse. Some of these structures are inside the nose, which is the functional rhinoplasty, the functional nose surgery. And some of these structures are around the neck or the eyebrow. So again, not all patients are candidate, not every headache patient is a candidate, but this can have a very positive impact in the right patient.
Dr. Afifi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate. This was fun.
Dr. Ahmed Afifi is an associate professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire senior Jenna Luganville is an intern in the campus's study abroad office. She manned one of dozens of tables at the school's first study abroad fair in more than a year. Luganville spent the fall of 2019 at England's Winchester University and says it was the best time of her life. That makes her excited for all of the students learning about their own options for study abroad.
I mean, it feels good to see that students are finally actually being able to go and having programs not be canceled, you know, almost instantly once students are accepted.
In March 2020, study abroad programs were halted at UW-Eau Claire and other campuses across the U.S., but things are slowly getting back to normal. In July, three students from UW-Eau Claire traveled with faculty to Central Europe for a three-week immersion trip to Germany, the Czech Republic, and Austria. Jeff DeGrave works in the study abroad office and helped organize the trip, where students learned about culture, politics, and conflicts in the region.
And within 2 weeks of us returning, the numbers had gone up, and the European Union said they would not allow non-essential travelers to Europe from the United States till further notice. So it was a window in time.
UW-Eau Claire senior Anna Green is hoping for a second chance at studying abroad before graduating next year. In March 2020, she was 3 weeks into a semester abroad in Chile when she was recalled. Now, Green is scheduled to spend 2 weeks in Guatemala next spring. COVID-19 infections are now high in the Central American nation, but she prefers to be on the optimistic side and says students should go for it.
This might be your chance. You just might be able to go and have that experience you've been dreaming of. And if you just don't at least try and go for it, well, then you're not ever going to have that possibility. That opportunity.
National surveys suggest last year's cancellations led to more than $1 billion in lost revenues for schools running study abroad programs. While programs are restarting, the COVID-19 pandemic has added a long list of hurdles to an already complex process. Melissa Torres is the president of the national nonprofit Forum on Education Abroad. She says U.S. State Department travel advisories are taking the local status of the pandemic into account, and that can change quickly.
So when you're a university trying to plan 6, 12, or 18 months out and enrolling students and having them choose their courses and lining up faculty to run some of these programs or working with overseas partners, it's really problematic.
Torrey says colleges are now using additional sources like the World Health Organization or reports from university partners abroad. She says larger colleges are likely having an easier time with it than smaller schools with less staff. Scott Pearson heads the Office of International Education at UW-Stout. He says there are usually more than 200 students abroad in a typical year. Pearson says 4 students are overseas this semester.
That was a breakthrough, a milestone for us to say, like, well, we're finally back at it. We finally have students exploring and enjoying the world again.
During a walk to the grocery store in the Belgian city of Kortrijk, UW-Stout senior Melissa Neumeier used her phone to record sounds from the neighborhood she's living in while spending a semester at Howest University. Neumeier says she was nervous about leaving home and calls mailing visa paperwork and notarized COVID-19 test results a debacle. But after a week of campus orientation and meeting fellow international students, she says it was all worth it.
Even before my classes, I've definitely opened my eyes and I've become more confident in myself. And just being able to be in a different country and further my skill set.
Schools are hopeful more students will be able to gain that kind of confidence again soon. A recent survey of universities found a majority expect to reach pre-pandemic levels of study abroad participation next year. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And just ahead, we speak with 2 archaeologists about how climate instability played a part in bringing down some of the world's greatest ancient civilizations. We get a tour through time and space. What questions do you have about how ancient societies crumbled? What role do you think that climate change played in their downfall? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.